You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear from an Eau Claire native whose Olympic event combines cross-country skiing and ski jumping.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Some of Wisconsin's top lawmakers are saying that it's time to bring toll roads to the state as a way to get federal transportation funds.
Also, Governor Walker has proposed a sales tax holiday and changes to his child tax credit plan. And in a few minutes, we'll look at an amendment to a bill affecting Wisconsin's wetlands.
J.R. Ross is the editor of WisPolitics.com. J.R., welcome back to Central Time.
How are you guys doing today?
We're doing pretty well. So earlier this week, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said that bringing open road tolling to Wisconsin is going to be basically the only way for the state to get federal transportation funding. This is a plan that President Trump proposed, an infrastructure plan. So first off, why is that proposed federal plan making Fitzgerald bring this up right now?
Because we haven't seen final details of that federal plan. It's supposed to be out early next week. But what the early reports suggest is that the federal government, the Trump administration, wants to offer a carrot to states, cities, and private companies to raise revenues to then stimulate these infrastructure projects. So it wouldn't just be roads, there would be broadband, some other stuff. But in order to qualify, you have to raise new revenue. Well, we have an issue in Wisconsin where Republicans have been in charge now pretty much for 7 years. And they really haven't been able to figure out a plan to raise revenue, additional transportation revenues, because they don't agree, one, if it's needed, and two, how they would do it if they wanted to. I mean, think back this past budget. There's this huge fight between Governor Walker and some of the Republicans about the gas tax. And Governor Walker has said over and over again he wouldn't allow a gas tax increase unless there was an offsetting tax cut somewhere else. So when Fitzgerald's talking about open road tolling, he's talking about what might be a viable option in this environment that could pass both houses and get the governor's support and then qualify for that federal money. And these are a lot of ifs right now. I mean, we don't know what that transportation package looks like, what the requirements are to raise revenue, and honestly, I mean, we're getting close to the session. I'm not sure these guys could get a plan done in the next 6 weeks. This may be part of the discussion for the next budget in 2019.
So you kind of gave what seemed like a little bit of a hint, but where does Governor Walker stand on the idea of toll roads?
Well, during last year, in the discussion about the transportation budget, he said if tolling was going to come to Wisconsin, he'd only like it around the state borders to try and catch people coming in to visit. He would want to see a corresponding decrease in taxes for Wisconsin residents to offset it. And that's a key thing with Governor Walker. Whatever you're talking about comes with transportation funding. If you're going to raise a tax or a fee or something like tolling, he wants to then cut taxes for Wisconsinites somewhere else. So it would kind of give up some of that money that might come in. Now, this week, after Fitzgerald and Voss at the County Association talked about tolling, Governor Walker's asked about it. He made quite clear he's not bringing it up. He's not proposing it. But if these guys are putting it on the table, I'll talk about it. But if it's out there, again, there's got to be a cut somewhere else.
And transportation funding has been a pretty big issue. Pretty much anyone in the state might complain about the roads. And even in the legislature, this is a bipartisan issue. You have Fitzgerald in support of it. You have Assembly Minority Leader Gordon Hintz in support of it. It's bipartisan. It's got some broad bipartisan support. Do you think that that could push Governor Walker along a little bit?
Maybe it might be that the dynamic has changed because of this federal package. We've got to see the details and what the requirements are to qualify for some of that money. That might put some pressure on these guys to do something. But we've been through these discussions for several years now about transportation revenues. Instead, we've borrowed more money in Wisconsin to pay for our roads. We're now paying roughly 22 cents of every dollar in the transportation fund just goes to retire debt. And that's it. That's doubled. I want to say like in at least a decade or so, it's doubled. That is not a sustainable level, according to some people I talked to. So what are they going to do? I honestly don't think they have an answer right now. They're trying to find a path forward with this dynamic of the federal transportation package, which hopefully we'll see soon and know exactly what we have to do to get that money.
Yeah, so, I mean, we don't have a crystal ball. We don't know. Governor Walker, again, has said that he's confident that Wisconsin will be able to match any federal funds kind of regardless or without toll roads or new taxes. I guess putting it baldly, I mean, is that money just going to potentially come from borrowing even more?
Well, you know, they're just throwing out options, I've heard. So we have the transportation fund is made up of your gas taxes, your registration fees, those kinds of things. There's the general fund, your income taxes, sales taxes, those excise taxes, that stuff, corporate taxes. You know, one idea I've heard is you could take money from the sale of cars, the sales tax on cars, auto parts, those kinds of things, and carve that out for transportation. Now, if you do that, you are taking money away from what the general fund usually pays for, schools, medical assistance programs, governor operations, state aid to local governments, all those things. So it's not really a pleasant option sometimes, but there are things like that you can try. Or you can do what Governor Walker's been talking about of, okay, you want to raise the gas tax by whatever, then find a tax cut somewhere else and offset that. The argument with the gas tax has been that it captures not just Wisconsinites, but people visiting here. Now, politically, that is somewhat of a divisive issue. I mean, if you look at polls, it's kind of split, depending which one you look at, you know, kind of around 50-50. But the Republican base does not like the idea of a gas tax hike, and that would be a problem for Republicans if they want to try to do that.
We're talking to J.R. Ross right now. He's the editor of WisPolitics.com. He's with us for our weekly roundup of Wisconsin news. And J.R., sticking with both taxes and Governor Walker announced a tweak to the $100 child tax credit he proposed during the State of the State address. He introduced the idea also of a sales tax holiday in the state. Can you give us some of the details of what he's asking for there?
Originally, Governor Walker wanted to do a $100 per child credit in this year. Basically, it'd be a sales tax rebate. If you had a child under the age of 18 as of December 31st, you go register with the state, you get a check for $100 this fall sometime. Problem is that for some Republicans I talked to, is that proposal would have hit 671,000 households out of 2.3 million. So not necessarily hitting as many people as they'd like. This new version would keep the one-time sales tax rebate this year, so the checks out in July, and then pair it with a sales tax holiday in early August that would, in theory, be available to everybody. So it also would up the price by about $50 million, so about $172-ish million versus $122 for just the per-child credit. What Walker is trying to do is we have a surplus that's projected, the middle of 2019. He wants to send that money back. Now, obviously, there's a political piece to this, right? It's an election year. If you're sending checks back to voters, he's hoping that they'll make a connection of, oh, Republicans are in charge. We have a surplus. I got a check because of their policy. That's what he wants people to kind of feel. The issues, though, are some lawmakers, Republicans I talked to, have concerns about the original plan because it would have gone into the future. It would have been added a new income tax deduction. It would have been refundable. So even if you had no tax liability, you still would have gotten the credit. It also would have tied up money in future budgets that would have made it harder to do other tax changes. So this new proposal is an effort to keep that benefit in this year, spread it to everybody in some shape or form, but also not tie the state into it in future years. This would not carry forward in the future years on the new plan. The problem is, the Senate caucus, Republican caucus, has not bought into it yet. This is a deal between Governor Walker and the Assembly Speaker. And until you have the Senate Republicans on board, it's not going to pass. So they're still trying to figure out where they're at on that proposal before the session ends.
Yeah, and it's been interesting to see the response from both Democrats and Republicans. It's also, as you said, an election year. Voicing for both sides, do you think that the Republican cohort will be on board with this as sort of the plan shakes out, or do you think that we could see some resistance from Democrats at the state legislature over it?
Democrats so far are not going to say it's election year gimmick. It's in the words of Gordon Hintz, an election year bribe. Gordon Hintz is the Assembly Minority Leader. They are totally knocking this. I don't get the impression right now they're going to help pass that bill. Now, if it gets to the floor of both houses, we'll see. You know, giving back money can be politically popular. But right now, you know, they're not offering much help. So it's all about Republicans. Can they get together and find something they both like? Senate Republicans caucus on Tuesday next week, I believe. That'll be a big meeting because if you know the Senate Republican caucus, it's got these wings, this kind of more moderate wings, more conservative one. They have 18 members right now. They will lose one member on any bill and still get it passed with just Republican support. That caucus will help determine what bills move this session, and they'll kind of hash out where they're at on things like this credit. Now, they may not come to a final resolution, but we should have a better idea by the middle of next week of what's going to happen with this credit and other bills that are still waiting out there in the session.
JR, that's all we have time for today. JR, thank you so much for being here today.
Anytime. Have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too. J.R. Ross is the editor of WisPolitics.com. He joined us for our weekly recap of the top news in Wisconsin.
Coming up, the Winter Olympics are kicking off. We'll be able to see the opening ceremony tonight.
The Wisconsin Olympics are kicking off with the opening ceremonies on TV tonight, and we continue our coverage of Wisconsin Olympians who are competing in the Games.
Ben Loomis is a 19-year-old athlete from Eau Claire who's representing Team USA in the Winter Olympics. He's in the Nordic combined event, which combines cross-country skiing and ski jumping.
WPR's Maureen McCullum recently caught up with Loomis before he headed off to compete in South Korea.
So you're from Eau Claire, and you're also 19 years old, correct?
Yep, that's correct.
Okay.
I grew up in Eau Claire and was there until I was 15, and then I moved to Park City, Utah.
To really focus on your sport, right?
Yep. Yeah, I moved there primarily to go to a special school. It was called the Winter Sports School of Park City, and that was a charter school, actually, for about 100 kids, and what made it so special and really unique is that we would start school year in April, and then we'd finish the school year in November, so we'd have entire winter off to travel, compete, train, and really, really worked out well for all winter athletes.
Wow. So you have qualified in the Nordic combined event, and Nordic combined is ski jumping and cross-country skiing combined. So basically, two sports in one event.
Yes.
So why is it, how is it that you got involved in that?
My family's always been into Nordic skiing. My dad picked it up, and my brother and I both started when we were really young, about 2 to 4 years old. Kind of first started walking around on skis. And actually, my brother really got me into the sport. He's 6 years older than me, and he saw the 2002 Olympics in Salt Lake City, and he watched the Nordic combined event, and he had already been a cross-country skier. So he thought it'd be cool if he could learn ski jumping also. And it turned out we had a local jump in our town, the Flying Eagle Ski Club right in Eau Claire. So we both kind of got started at the same time. I was about 5 years old and he was 10, and kind of just grew from there.
Wow. I'm just like, I can't imagine. First of all, the idea of ski jumping is terrifying to me. But being 5 years old and having the courage to ski jump is really incredible.
Yeah, and of course you start on really, really little hills.
Sure.
They put you on alpine skis to start, so you're just kind of going through the motions, going over little bumps, and just learning basic ski skills, and then you can progress from there.
So do you know the history of the event at all? Like, why is it that at some point in time, some Nordic folks decided that they wanted to put ski jumping and cross-country skiing together in one event?
I think it started from cross-country skiing, and they would be walking around on their skis, and they would build little jumps and say, hey, who can go the furthest off this? And it just began from that. They used to use all the same equipment, and they would just go out and have fun and cross-country ski and then combine it with some ski jumping, and it just grew from there.
Huh. So when you're ski jumping in the Nordic combined event, how high or how far are you jumping? And is there any way you can kind of help us put that into perspective, like that distance or the height?
Yeah, so in a typical Olympic-sized ski jump, there's actually two different sizes, and usually it's a 90-meter hill and a 120-meter hill. And what that means is that's roughly how far you can fly. So, for example, on the 120-meter hill, that 120 meters would be a good jump, and the best jumpers will go even further than that. So on a hill like that, the best ski jumpers are flying over a football field in length.
Wow. And how far, what's your farthest
distance? Furthest jump is 136 meters, which is over 500 feet.
Holy cow. That's amazing. So when you're up there, when you're ski jumping, like, what is that like? What's going through your head?
Well, we've done it so many times that it just becomes second nature, I could say. And we're able to just really focus on usually one or two things that we're trying to work on in our ski jumping and just put everything else out of our mind and just have a clear mind and clear head and kind of let the muscle memory take over.
I would love to be at a point in my life when flying felt like second nature.
Yeah, it's a very unique experience, and once you learn how to do it, it really, there's nothing like it.
One of my coworkers wants to know if you scream anything in the air as you're jumping.
No, definitely you're staying quiet and you're not able to hear any of the crowd, and you're just kind of looking forward and focused on going as far as you can and landing well.
So focusing on the cross-country portion of this sport, when you all are out there, it's a 10K course, right? That's about a little over 6 miles.
Yep.
And you are all going incredibly fast, right?
Yeah, 10K is a unique distance because it's not quite a sprint event, but it's still really fast and really hard the whole time through. And our courses are typically 4 laps, so each lap generally gets faster and faster and a little bit harder. Yeah, that makes it really exciting, really challenging.
It's incredible to me that you can be talented in both events. Like, you have to be light and have this extreme lower body strength for ski jumping, but then this incredible endurance for cross-country skiing. Is it like a delicate balance for you as an athlete?
Absolutely. That's what makes Nordic Mind so interesting, is it's balancing the two different sports. The more you train for one sport, the worse you get at the other one. So it's a really fine line of balancing them and being able to train both of them really hard and training both sides smartly too.
So how do you find that delicate balance?
Well, it takes years and years of training. I would say there's definitely guys on the World Cup that are really strong jumpers and not so good at skiing, and vice versa. So it takes a lot of time, a lot of training, and just really competing against other guys to figure out exactly what your strengths are, what your weaknesses are that you need to work on.
So right now you're in Switzerland. You're at the Junior World Championship. How's that going?
Yeah, so far it's been going great. We had our first competition this Tuesday, and I took a bronze medal in that, which was
congrats.
Really big. That was my goal going into the championships. So that was really exciting. And then we also had another team competition today that we finished seventh in, and I think that was a pretty good result from our team. We all had good performances either on the cross-country course or the jump hill, so overall it was a very solid day.
That's great. So now you're heading to the Olympics. Congratulations. That must feel amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very excited.
I mean, what was that feeling like when you realized I qualified?
Yeah, it was almost surreal. For me, it took a little time to process that and really come to grips with the fact that I'm representing the U.S. and going to the Olympics. It set in over, I'd say, the course of a few days. I knew I had a really good shot kind of closing down on the qualification period. So when it finally became official, it was definitely a big relief and really exciting.
And your brother, Adam Loomis, he's also on Team USA. He didn't qualify this year, but is there a hope that maybe in the future that you two would be able to compete together?
Yeah, unfortunately, he didn't have quite as best year this winter. And I think if he keeps going, he definitely has a really good shot. And next Olympics coming up, so that would be really cool if we could both be on the same Olympic team someday.
So in these days leading up to the Winter Games, how exactly are you preparing?
So I'm mostly trying to just, you know, kind of focus and treat it like any other competition, not overthink things and not really try any harder than I would in other competitions, because that's when you make mistakes, is when you try too hard and change your routine and make changes to your sport.
So do you have expectations for yourself at the Winter Games?
I don't have expectations in terms of numbers. I'm just hoping to put down a really good performance and jump at the level I know I'm capable of. And if I can just put my best foot forward, then I'll be happy.
So the athletes you'll be competing against, have you competed against some of them before, or a lot of these people, are they new to you?
I've competed against pretty much every athlete, I would say. They're all World Cup athletes and competed on World Cup a few times now. And there's also some junior athletes that I'm really good friends with that will be there as well that I've battled with, especially like at a junior world championships like this week. There's a few athletes going to the Olympic Games next week as well.
So besides competing, is there anything you're excited, maybe other sports you're excited to watch at the Olympics?
Yeah, definitely. It will be pretty exciting being able to watch like cross-country skiing, for example. I'm a really big fan of, obviously, because I do the sport, and they're really kind of coming up and a really good shot at some medals. And of course, some of the other new sports, hockey and alpine skiing, obviously the U.S. is doing well at, and I think those could be really exciting.
And will your family be over there with you?
My parents will be.
That's great. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And best of luck to you. We'll all be rooting for you back here in Wisconsin.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yep. Have a good one.
That was WPR's Maureen McCollum talking with Ben Loomis, an Eau Claire native who is competing in the Winter Olympics in the Nordic combined event.
Earlier this week, President Trump shared his thoughts about how Democrats acted during his first State of the Union address when they chose not to applaud. Here's the president.
They were like death. And un-American. Un-American. Somebody said treasonous. I mean, yeah, I guess why not? Can we call that treason? Why not? I mean, they certainly didn't seem to love our country very much.
Those remarks stirred up a flurry of reaction about the use of the word treasonous. Our next guest says they fit into a rhetorical strategy that President Trump has used since the beginning of his campaign for president.
Jennifer Murcia is an associate professor in the Department of Communication at Texas A&M University and is writing a book about President Trump's rhetorical style. She's with us for a look at the tools used by the president when he speaks and the state of American political rhetoric. Jen, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with that that moment from the president there, a pretty recent example. How does that fit into the tools you've seen the president use when he's speaking publicly?
Yeah, I've been following him pretty carefully since about December of 2015. And what I've noticed is that he uses six rhetorical strategies consistently. He did it throughout the campaign, and he does it still as president. And that's an example of paralipses. And paralipses can be said colloquially as, I'm not saying, I'm just saying. So in that case, it was, you know, I'm not saying that they are traitors or that they're treasonous, but, you know, someone said it. And why not? Why wouldn't we call him that? It's a way of saying two things at once. So you can't really hold him accountable for saying it.
And there are other examples of this where he might start something saying a lot of people are saying or something like that, something to attribute it to others and not, or say, I'm not going to say they're weak or something like that. So he could say it and not say it at the same time.
That's exactly right. and it's great because it's sort of funny when he does it. You know, you heard the audience laugh in this case. And it allows you to think that you have a kind of window into the secret inner thoughts of Donald Trump. And so it's a way of connecting with his audience. You know, he's revealing to you what he really thinks, even though he knows that he really shouldn't say what he really thinks.
And one thing I think everybody would probably agree on, like it or not, Donald Trump does not talk like your average politician. Some people have been shocked or dismayed by the way he talks. Some people love it. We've heard a lot of callers, I think at different parts of the political spectrum on this show, saying they appreciate that he doesn't have that sort of guarded, careful, presidential-style language. Can you talk about just the general different way of talking of Donald Trump?
Yeah, and that's definitely true. So his whole campaign was built around this idea that he wasn't going to be politically correct. He was going to tell you just what he thought, and that you knew that he was doing that because of the, you know, way that he talked to people. Some people, of course, accused him of being offensive, insulting, and I think that's probably fair. But he thought that that meant that he was honest and direct, that he wasn't beholden to special interests or lobbyists, and that he was going to solve the problems of America. And so he was able to convince his followers, I think, that the way that he talked actually signaled to them that he was a man of action and that he was going to get things done on their behalf.
I want to get into another example, another one of the rules or tools you see the president using. I learned some Latin in reading what you wrote, a technique called ad baculum. I'm going to play an example here, and then you can tell us what ad baculum is. Here's President Trump.
Hillary wants to essentially abolish the Second Amendment. By the way, and if she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is, I don't know. But I'll tell you what, that will be a horrible day.
A lot of people drew attention to that one back during the campaign as an implied threat, and that's what ad baculum is. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. So it's a threat of force. And in the case of the example that you played, he does sort of pair it with this almost paralipses, right? This almost, you know, I wouldn't say you should do this, but maybe you would. And that's common for him, is that he will imply that maybe a threat ought to be carried out, but he won't say it in such a direct way that you could actually tell, like, and maybe hold him up in a court of law as being responsible for threatening. So he did this a lot with protesters at his rallies. You know, when a protester was being escorted out, he would say, you know, I say, don't hurt them, don't hurt them. I always say, don't hurt them, because if I say hurt them, then I'll get into trouble. So I'm saying, don't hurt them. You know, they're nice people, whatever. And so, you know, it sounds like it could be that he wants you to hurt the protester, but you couldn't actually prove that in a court of law. So he's very tricky about the way that he uses his words.
And we've seen this a few times since he became president at press conferences. His spokesperson, often Sarah Huckabee Sanders, in clarifying, for example, the treasonous remarks, will say, well, the president was joking in this instance, and that room is left there to say that, right?
Absolutely. He leaves himself an out every time. Trump is really, really good at it. He's strategic in the way that he uses language. He's very consistent. So like I said, I noticed things that he did in December of 2015 that he kept doing throughout his campaign that he still does as president. Very consistent. But he's very strategic, and he leaves himself plausible deniability so that he can't be held accountable.
Is there a skill here? People look at President Trump speaking, especially at his rallies. These are long speeches in many cases, spontaneous in many ways, not teleprompters. A lot of those he uses them sometimes, but often not. And yet you're saying he's very consistent.
Oh, he is very consistent. So he has like set pieces, like a stand-up comedian does. If you watched a lot of his rallies, like I did for the book that I'm writing, you know, he has certain topics that he will do almost the same bit each time. Sometimes the words change a little bit. Sometimes he has them in different order. But, you know, it's the same as any other kind of politician who would do a stump speech. And Trump was doing a set piece. He just was kind of riffing off of the audience and whatnot. So it was very consistent.
We're talking to Jen Mercia, Associate Professor of Communication at Texas A&M University. She has been looking at President Trump and candidate Donald Trump's speaking style, and she saw a bunch of different tools that the president used as a candidate, uses as president. Another strategy that he uses can be heard in this bit from President Trump.
So let me ask you, because this is like, this place is packed.
Yeah.
Does everybody get this kind of a crowd?
No. No.
It's very easy. That's why he keeps calling me back.
So, Jenna, how does this fit into the tools you lay out?
Yeah, so that's an ad populum appeal, appealing to the wisdom of the crowd. And so Trump loved his rallies. He loved the energy of the rallies. He thought that his rallies were the best investment of his campaign because people had a good time. They went back and told their friends about it. And he just, he loved the sort of energy of being around people who were applauding for him and cheering for him. And the argument by ad populum is the same thing that we saw with, you know, the way he talked about his poll numbers, you know, whenever he was doing well in the polls, or talked about crowd size at his rallies, or talked about crowd size, you know, even at the inauguration. All of those are ad populum appeals, the wisdom of the crowd. The crowd knows more than the establishment. The crowd knows more than the media. The crowd knows more than any expert, and they love Trump. Right? That was key.
And Jen, let's take a step aside from the tools you're talking about. Another question you explore is President Trump a demagogue? First of all, what is a demagogue, and how do we apply that term to a modern American politician?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question to me, and this is the focus of my book. If you look up the word demagogue in the Oxford English Dictionary, the OED, you actually get two absolutely contradictory definitions. The first one is that a demagogue is the leader of the people who defends the interests of the people against the other parts of the state, the other corrupt parts of the state. The second definition is a political leader who uses polarizing language to divide the people for their own gain. So Donald Trump ran. His whole campaign was premised on demagoguery. He ran as a demagogue in the good sense of the word, right? And his followers believe, still today, I believe, that that he was and is a demagogue in the good sense, that he is a popular leader that emerges, you know, sort of somewhat from the people. And he speaks their language, and that he is defending their interests against the other parts of the state, the political parties, the media, who are corrupt. Other people, of course, see him as a polarizing figure and as a demagogue in the negative sense of the word. So in my book, I'm trying to sort of explain how he could be both of those things at the same time, and how he used demagogic rhetorical appeals in the negative sense to prevent himself from being held accountable for his actions.
Jen Mercia is with us, associate professor in the Department of Communication at Texas A&M University. We're talking about President Trump's rhetorical style.
800-642-1234 is the number to call to join our conversation. What do you like or not like about President Trump's rhetorical style? Do you think his methods are changing American political rhetoric? Do you think political rhetoric is improving or getting harsher? You can also email your thoughts to ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. Jen, before we get back to some of the tools you list out, we've been talking about whether the president is changing American political rhetoric, the way politicians talk. Could someone else do what he does?
I think it would be very difficult for someone else to do it. And we've seen some people try. So during the campaign, if you remember, Rubio tried to use some of the ad hominem tactics against Trump, tried to attack him personally instead of attacking his arguments. And it didn't play out very well for him. So when he attacked Trump for having small hands, Rubio came out looking badly. And I think we've seen, you know, some Democrats try to use like intense language, swear words, and that rings very false. I think that Trump has built up a kind of immunity for himself. And so he is immune from criticism for saying a lot of things, but other people probably wouldn't be. So I don't think that we're going to see, you know, an avalanche of Trumps out there. I don't think it's possible.
You mentioned the ad hominem attack. That's another one of the tools you write about. Here's an example. The president talking here about rival Republican presidential candidate John Kasich and his eating habits.
He has a news conference all the time when he's eating. I have never seen a human being eat in such a disgusting fashion.
A lot of comments like this. We played the president talking about Mitt Romney walking like a penguin at one point. Talk about this as a rhetorical tool.
Yeah, so it's a polarizing strategy. He is pointing his finger at his opponents and inviting us to ridicule them. So ridicule Kasich for the way that he eats, ridicule Romney for the way that he walks, ridicule Jeb Bush for being low energy. Those are, you know, us versus them strategies. And so instead of dealing with their policies or their policy criticisms that they might have about Trump, instead of doing that, he goes for ad hominem attacks, which are absolutely about pitting, you know, us, the good guys, versus them, the bad guys. They're polarizing strategies.
Let's go to our callers now. We have Kelly on the line in Cascade. Kelly, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What did you want to bring up?
I just have a very visceral response to Trump. I mean, ever since he was on the campaign trail, it's just been very hard for me to even hear what he has to say. All I can hear is the energy and the polarization efforts. I just feel like it's somehow it always seems to point back to him being this wonderful, amazing person that we should all bow down to. And it rubs against everything that I feel our country stands for and that I would want in a leader.
Kelly, thanks so much for your call. And Jen, she said a visceral reaction. I bet you could see that word applied to people who hate the way the president talks and love the way he talks.
Yeah, absolutely. The people who go to his rallies, you know, you can see them just enjoying it. He is a very polarizing figure, and he does inspire great affection and enthusiasm from the people who see him as a demagogue in the good sense. They see him defending their interests. Likewise, just like Kelly, there's a great big segment of the population that sees him in a really negative way and has that visceral negative response. That is Trump. He is just a polarizing figure. And I think that he invites that kind of polarization through the way that he talks. I mean, he really is trying to divide the country into us versus them.
Kelly, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Deanne in Eau Claire. Deanne, hi.
Hi. I guess my comment is that I feel that, you know, our intellects on both sides here are giving Donald Trump too much credit. I don't believe that he actually has a style per se. I think, you know, he's just simply a bully. And like a lot of bullies, he's all over the place and serving his purpose. I have never seen Donald Trump in all of the years that I've watched him. I mean, he's 20 years older than me, but he's been in the news my adult life. I've never seen him as anybody that had, you know, an intelligent opinion, highly educated.
Deanne, thanks for the call. What do you think, John?
Yeah, I think that you're right that he is a bully. And I guess the question is whether you think he's a bully for the right reasons or the wrong reasons. So his followers certainly see that him as a bully for the right reasons, not so much his detractors. You know, it's hard to judge his intellect. He will certainly tell you that he's among the smartest or the greatest or went to the best schools with the best words. And that's, you know, something that he'll tell you consistently. But what I've noticed in following him and watching all of his rallies and all of that for years now is that he is incredibly consistent. And part of it is that he's an incredibly consistent bully. So he uses the ad baculum threats. He uses the ad hominem attacks. He uses the paralipses so he can't be held accountable. He does all these things very strategically. I've been trying to, I think, coin a word because I've looked it up and it doesn't seem to be a word. But he's aethical, meaning that he doesn't consider ethics in how he talks. He considers strategy, trying to get his goal and what he can say to achieve those goals. And so I think that, you know, people like Kelly and Deanne might say that Trump is unethical in the way that he talks. I might also say that, but I don't think that he considers ethics. So I think that he's aethical, if that were a word.
Thanks for the call, Deanne. We're talking to Jen Merchia about President Trump's rhetorical strategies, the way he talks in his rallies and elsewhere. Back to your calls now. Anita is with us in Bessemer, Michigan. Anita, hi.
Hi. Really an interesting show. I'm listening to your guest, and I'm a dictionary. I always look up stuff in the dictionary. And demagogue comes from a Greek word meaning demos, the people, and the other part, agigas, meaning leader, one who tries to stir up people's emotions so as to gain power. So I found that very interesting.
Anita, thanks. Another definition than the OED you mentioned, but along the same lines, Jen.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's such an interesting word for me. I started studying demagoguery about 10 years ago, well before I became interested in Donald Trump. And my interest was largely in that contradictory way that we think about the word when we look it up in the dictionary versus the always negative way that we talk about a demagogue. And it's interesting to me because, I mean, a leader of the people, as she said, as Anita said, you know, that's the etymology of the word. And wouldn't we want someone to emerge from the people to lead the people? We would. So why is a demagogue a negative thing is how I sort of got interested originally in it, because I like word meaning too, Anita. And then got more interested in their techniques and strategies.
And Jen, what are you watching for as the Trump presidency goes on, just briefly as we wrap up?
Well, I'm interested to see if he ever allows himself to be held accountable. That, to me, is sort of the defining feature of the demagogue in the negative sense. So we wouldn't want a leader who's unaccountable, who you can't, you know, rein in. That's why we have a system of checks and balances. That's why we are fearful of demagogues, you know, when we're fearful of them. And so my interest in watching him is to see if somebody can finally control him and how that plays out, because he's been very crafty so far.
Jen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Jen Mercia, associate professor in the Department of Communication at Texas A&M University. She's working on a book about President Trump's rhetorical style.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll check out a new plan from UW-Madison to provide free tuition for students from families making less than $56,000 a year.
Most economic growth in the United States is happening in larger urban areas, but a guest says policymakers should not give up on smaller cities and rural areas.
And Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine is back with us for a look at some of the most intriguing stories from the worlds of science.
That and look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. It's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Monday after 7 on the State Capitol Report, Kate gets two takes on the idea of toll roads coming to Wisconsin. That's Monday morning after 7 on the morning show.
Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll break down the spending deal that Congress passed earlier this morning. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.